today I want to finish up the, by all means, finish up the sources of energy, and then very quickly go over the some of the policy options. I'm just going to leave unfinished, and you can read about it. And Friday, then, we'll look at the question of lifestyles. And the paper that I handed out at the outset, does everybody still have that? I noticed that I don't have any copies left. I just have an outline of it that I... So, Marilyn, if Marilyn's going to respond to that, I think she has an earlier version of it. I hope that it's close to what the current version is. Those of you who don't have that paper will have to check with somebody else. Let me conclude then on solar and then briefly sketch a few of the what I would call solar derivatives. We've been talking about solar, small passive installations, photovoltaic cells, large collector systems, large power plants resulting from that, and the use of parabolic mirrors to focus on a boiler, various systems, space satellites. The overall problems with solar are, at this point, cost, the intermittency in some areas, that is to say in the areas like the Northwest, because of cloud cover, it makes the constant use of solar problematic. And the problem of storage, no effective or adequate storage system. I would say really adequate, because we do have rock systems and things like that to do store solar to some degree, but not very good yet. And so during the dark hours, when there is no solar power, you have to have something to carry over that period. One of the things to do is to pump water uphill with solar and at night let it run downhill. That's the other proposal. The advantages to solar, of course, are considerable. It's reliable, particularly in areas with considerable sunshine. It's simple, safe, and simplicity, of course, is one of our criteria of appropriateness. It's safe, at least in comparison to its neighbors. No energy source is completely safe. Has a free and renewable fuel, the sun, at least for the foreseeable future. The sun will someday burn out, but that's certainly down the pike through many reincarnations, I'm sure. Has very low environmental impact, to impart a rather foreign doctrine to Christian discussions. Has a very low environmental impact, and is plentiful, interestingly, in poor parts of the world, areas where and other kinds of energy, such as coal, is not very plentiful at all. So that's basically that what we call solar in its core phenomenon. Now, there are solar derivatives. Solar, we already have quite a few uses of solar, and right here in this village, solar is already the number one and almost exclusive fuel, except for some use of diesel here and there, the almost exclusive fuel in this village, in wood and in hydro. So hydro is the first one, probably the most important of the solar derivatives, and that's solar because the hydrological cycle is driven by the sun. The water here in the Northwest coming in off the ocean in the cyclonic storms that come regularly, particularly in the winter, falls here in the mountains, and then the water flows downhill. Now the potential for hydro I'll just read a figure, 3 million megawatts, of which about one-tenth of the potential in the world is developed. Here in the Northwest, that is misleading, because almost all the good hydro sites in the Pacific Northwest are now used. There are some other sites. They're talking about raising Ross Dam, for example, to the north of us here, and a little bit to the west. But basically, most of the good hydro sites in the Northwest are used. And hydro provides 50% of the power, electrical power, that is, not gasoline for cars, but 50% of the electrical power in the Pacific Northwest. And that totals out to be about 4% of the national amount. Now, that's considerable, but again, the Pacific Northwest is about the only place where that, here in the United States, where that is potentially a large source.
What's your other hand?
Well, it would be coal. There's two nuclear power plants down at Tanford, one at Rainier in Oregon, several coal power plants. There's a big strip mine with a coal plant at Bucota near Centralia in Washington, and I assume there's several other coal power plants here and there. I'm not sure where all those are located. There are some areas, however, still potential. Africa, for one, is got a lot of potential left. You know, you're familiar with the Aswan Dam in Egypt, of course. Now, there's problems with hydro, despite the fact that it's a very clean, fairly simple. It's, again, it's a big kind of operation, so it's not doesn't fit into some criteria of appropriateness that we may want to hold. But it's clean, and the source is renewable. But there are certain problems. First of all, the limited potential. Second, there is the problem of silting up behind dams. Certain areas, this is very severe. Behind the Aswan Dam in Egypt, for example, there's already considerable silting. And the only way to remove that is to either drain your reservoir or to dredge, and both of which are not extremely sound ways of doing it. There's loss of certain species, fish species, in the building of dams. You're familiar with the Tellico Dam, perhaps, in Tennessee, and the snail darter, a very interesting case where a snail darter was a fish that only, they thought, inhabited this one stretch of the Tombigbee River, I think it was, and the building of the Tellico Dam would eliminate the snail darter. I have a friend in Tacoma who was one of the lawyers who started that case, They actually prevented for a while the building of that dam. Now, I think there's been a congressional law that has gone through to allow the building of that dam. But there is some losses. Loss of wild rivers. And in Egypt, with the Aswan Dam, there's been considerable problems with the increase of, what's the name of the disease? Schismatosis or something? Nurses, help me. There's a disease. Because of the spread of snails in Egypt, there a disease which they carry has spread, and indeed, secondly, the delta area, which used to be rich, is now having problems with certain kinds of fish species, which used to be receiving the nutrition, which is now blocked, and the soil that was now blocked by the Aswan Dam. And the annual flooding of the Nile now is no longer, so that artificial fertilizers have to be used. Well, anyway, hydropower has a lot of advantages and some disadvantages. And there's three or four other ones I briefly want to mention. Wind power, long history from sailboats to windmills. There's even recently an example here of some entrepreneurs who built a sailboat, and they were actually moving cargo by sail. And I think I read about 6 months ago that the boat sank in a storm, but there are some people at least who are back in the business of sailboats.
Tankers.
Is that right?
Yep.
Well, I know there was this one commercial venture, and I think the boat sank, but Japan is... interestingly, you get more power from big wind machines. The power output seems to go with the square of the size. In other words, you get a square of the size, so a small power double will produce four times squared of the amount of power from it. Again, it's a decentralized option that offers a lot of possibilities. Problem, of course, is intermittency. In many areas, there is not wind, and other areas, the wind comes and goes. Here in this valley, wind power would be ridiculous, because I don't think I've seen a breath of wind since I've been in here.
Last winter.
Is that right? This is one of the most phenomenal places I've ever seen. There's no wind in this valley. That down on the Columbia River to the south of us, where the winds funnel through the Columbia River Gorge, just to the east, out by Prosser or someplace like that, I think, they're actually building an installation, an experimental installation. I haven't been out there to look at it, but they tell me that it's working. And the reason it is because they have a steady flow coming up the Columbia River Gorge, the west winds funneling through that gorge. Again, well, maybe not long till you'll have a big windmill on top of your house generating electricity. Of course, you have to have backup systems, but again, every little bit helps. Wind power is not going to provide for the basic needs of all Americans or all people in the world, but if you put together a bunch of small sources, you may make a considerable impact on energy needs. There's two others that are kind of bizarre. The first, I'm not totally understand the
physics of them, but it has to do with ocean thermal gradients. In certain places of the world, you have warm water passing over the top of cold water. There's places in the Caribbean where, in about a 2,000 foot, over a span of about 2,000 feet, the water temperature changes about 30 or 40 degrees. Now, whenever there's that change in temperature, through the laws of physics, there is the potential of realizing some energy. Again, it's you have to move a lot of water from the bottom to the top and let it soak down through, I guess, to get that to get the potential out of that gradient. But it is potential. The big problem is trying to find water moving machines that can feasibly and economically do that. But ocean thermal gradients in certain parts of the world provide an excellent potential. And finally, tides. Well, not finally, there's one after tides. Certain places of the world, there is extremely high tides, and where these areas race through a fairly narrow area, you can build a dam and actually harness the tides. There is one power station operating in France which does precisely that. They have dammed up an estuary of a river in an area around the Brittany Peninsula where the tides are very high. I don't know what the exact height of tide there, but I suspect it's on the order of 20, 25 feet. And of course, in the Bay of Fundy off Nova Scotia, where you have tides of about 40 feet, there's been talk about damming up some of the entrances to some of the bays there. Nothing has been done there yet, but again, very potential source of energy. The problem, of course, is that it's, again, intermittent, certain times of day that you can use it, and so it has a potential of adding electricity at certain hours of the day, but those seldom coincide with peak use hours. So the potential there is not great. Experts estimate that there's only 30 spots in the world that are really potentially usable for tidal power. The final solar derivative is biomass, which is a kind of catch-all category of several different kinds. Basically, it's built on the notion, on the whole process of photosynthesis, which is what makes trees and plants grow. And photosynthesis of plants and trees trap about 1/20th of 1% of the sun's energy. And this amount of energy that is trapped can be harvested and burned or transferred into gas of various kinds. Perhaps 1/5th of that amount stored is potentially usable for energy. The forms this comes in are, first of all, waste from food processes, the fermentation of garbage, animal excrement from such things as feedlots, waste from lumber and pulp operations. But there's also the possibility of cropping, and that's sort of what we do right here in Holden Village and in this valley, with trees, cropping trees, and we cut them down and use them for fuel. That's a very good source of energy in this valley because there's ample trees and no one's about ready to start harvesting all these, so at least Holden can exist on biomass. But in certain areas of the world, there's really a crisis of firewood, particularly in India and in the slopes of the Himalayas in Nepal, where a lot of deforestation has been going on and actually is creating a lot of damage because when you remove the forest, you cause greater erosions and flooding. And the problem with flooding and erosion in Nepal is reaching epidemic proportions, according to some people. Eric Ekholm has written an article on it's been out for several years on the wood crisis, really. He thinks that's one of the primary crises in the world. India gets 30% of its energy from wood, and a place like Tanzania gets 96% of its energy from wood. But it doesn't take long. If any of you have been in the third world countries, you can see denuded hillsides all over the place. I can remember in the 60s in the Philippines, it's rather obvious that they had eliminated a good number of the woods and forests nearby the town that I was in, which had recently grown large because of a buildup for the Vietnam War. And the hillsides were not only ugly, but they certainly were exhausted in the supply. Now, wood is renewable, but it's not renewable if you use up more each year than it's produced. So the forestry as fuel has limitations as a source. There are techniques for biomass. One is direct combustion, such as burning of garbage or wood. fermentation to gas. You can let the garbage ferment and then trap the gas. And finally, there is cropping. Some people have talked about using corn and making gasohol from it. You've heard of gasohol as a possible energy source. Problem with gasohol is that you're using crops that could otherwise be used for food, and you have a trade-off between use of biomass for food and use for energy. But again, in certain areas, this is a very helpful kind of source of fuel. So in a sense, wood and hydro are Holden's two primary sources. Both come from this biomass. Both are renewable. So at least in this valley, that makes some sense in terms of the heating of the village. Just one other source, direct source, and then finally conservation to conclude this section. Geothermal is the final source that I care to mention. It's on the list here. Geothermal, there are a few places in the world where the crust of the earth is either has faults in it or is thin, where the actual heat of the earth can be used. In some areas, it already is heating water and producing steam. Where you have geysers, you have hot water coming out of fissures in the earth. And in some areas, you are able to trap this directly as steam, not just as water. Perhaps the most important area that's close to here occurs just north of San Francisco. Perhaps some of you who lived in San Francisco are aware of this. There's an area called the Geysers, just north, up by Clear Lake, just to the west of Clear Lake in Northern California. And it provides 4% of Pacific Gas and Electric, that's the main utility of San Francisco, provides 4% of their energy source. Basically what they do is they drill wells down about, how far is it? Oh, I hear 3,000 to 9,000 feet. And these wells produce steam and some impurities, by the way. And there's a certain odor, which is not very aesthetically pleasing because it's hydrogen sulfide, which emanates from these wells. And that has been the main complaint in Northern California. But this steam can be trapped and then made to turn turbines, which produce electricity, of course. Now, this area in Northern California and one in Italy are the only two that have been commercially tapped that I'm aware of. I suspect there are other ones.
There's an area in New Zealand.
In New Zealand as well. But it's a nice source. It's renewable. It's clean, except for the stink. And it's a free fuel. And there's some problem with wastewater. And it's cheap. Only hydro is less expensive, according to my sources. Again, a limited source, which has some people are worried about land subsidence, too, with geothermal. But there's been no confirmation that that's a problem yet. Finally, let's look at conservation, which with solar becomes the kind of primary source of energy, literally a source of energy. I want to call conservation a source of energy, and I want to call it that because for the following reasons. I want to read you from, just quickly, from this study by the Harvard Business School on energy, which is no radical group of people. They start their chapter on conservation as follows. There is a source of energy that produces no radioactive waste, nothing in the way of petrodollars, and very little pollution. Moreover, the source can provide the energy that conventional sources may not be able to furnish. Unhappily, however, it does not receive the emphasis and attention it deserves. The source might be called energy efficiency, for Americans like to think of themselves as an efficient people. But the energy source is generally known by the more prosaic term conservation. To be semantically accurate, the source should be called conservation energy, to remind us of the reality that conservation is no less an energy alternative than oil, gas, coal, or nuclear. Indeed, in the near term, conservation can do more than any of the conventional sources to help the country deal with the energy problems it faces. If the United States were to take a serious commitment to conservation, it might well consume, and this is a figure that's frequently cited by Lovins and other folk, it might well consume 30 to 40% less energy than it does now with the same, basically assuming with the same product, and still enjoy the same or even higher standard of living. That saving would not hinge on a major technological breakthrough, and it would require only modest adjustments in the way people live. Moreover, the cost of energy conservation is very competitive with other energy sources. The possible energy savings would be equivalent of the elimination of imported oil, and then some. That's quite a significant statement in favor of conservation, one of the strongest that I've heard, and from a group of people who are not what you would call counterculture types. In a way, conservation is an ideal fuel. It has no waste, no radioactivity, little of any pollution. There is pollution, of course, from the manufacture of certain conserving materials, and relatively inexpensive. The types of conservation basically are listed on the outline there is a form of reduced consumption. It's not part of the Harvard or Lovins thing to talk about reduced consumption. But in terms of Christians, I think that reduced consumption is one of the alternatives in conservation. And the second form, and the one that they, both the Harvard study and Lovins push, are more efficient production and distribution. Now, there's a lot of obstacles to conservation. First of all, we're not designed for conservation. We have been building up over several decades an attitude of unlimited expansion, and those attitudes really militate against any kind of effective conservation. We're also preoccupied often with a technological fix, that is to say that we'll solve our problems with new technologies rather than making efforts to conserve or to cut back. Furthermore, the lobbies that are seeking to increase energy expansion are quite great, and people working for conservation have very little and few organizations. But some comparisons reveal some of the startling figures on how much energy this country wastes. I'm saying waste because I think it's waste. Some would say that we just consume more per capita, and that may not be wasted. But it's, so waste is in a way, a value-loaded statement. But by comparison, the United States consumes 8.3 tons of oil per capita, I assume that's per year, whereas France consumes about 3.5, West Germany 4.5, and Sweden 6.1. Across the categories of energy production, this is just oil, but across the categories of energy production, we consume almost twice as much as most European countries. Some European countries are closer to our consumption. Now, that let me draw back from that statement a little bit because it's a slight bit misleading. One of the reasons we and the Canadians who consume more per capita than we do, one of the reasons why we have such high energy consumption is that there are many energy-intensive industries located in these countries, which are not located in many European countries. For example, aluminum. One of the reasons why the Canadians consume so much energy is the location of many aluminum factories in Canada, particularly up here in British Columbia around Prince Rupert, Kitimat, and so forth. But there are other differences. Just take Sweden for comparison, which is often used. They consume about 75% of the amount of energy that we do. And the reason is that they use fewer appliances. They travel 60% as much as Americans, use only 60% as much fuel per passenger mile in their automobiles, engage in little air travel, have attempted to introduce something called cogeneration. Cogeneration is where you use steam generated for industrial processes for heating, too. Many places in this country, manufacturing companies are generating steam for the manufacturing processes and importing steam or other forms of energy to heat their plants. Cogeneration is an attempt to heat and to use the same processes for heating and electricity as for the manufacturing of goods. The Swedes put a tax on the weight of cars and a high tax on gasoline, and they have oriented certain bank lending practices to lower energy consumption. In France, according to one article I read, there has outlawed all advertising which promotes the consumption of energy. It actually outlawed it.
Nothing would be empty. Gee, what would we have?
That's a remarkable kind of thing, which it would be very difficult to pull off in this country. But if you're really serious about conservation, and that would be one very effective. We've done it with cigarettes. I'm not sure. I think that the advertisers would raise a bigger stink because there's many more power groups that you're going to alienate, but still in all, it's a possibility. Now, the Swedes have shorter distances to travel. Their population is more dense. They haven't built up a suburban kind of pattern as we have. And they have very few, as I understand, very few aluminum industries. And the United States also has greater distances to transport goods and services. So there are differences that account for part of the differential between Sweden and the United States, but still in all, there's a lot that can be done in the United States to conserve energy. For example, just a few possibilities. In the field of transportation, autos consume 13% of the energy used in the United States, and fully 11% of the world's consumption of oil goes to the fueling of American automobiles. The use of public transit, carpooling, 55-mile-an-hour speed limit, the proper maintenance of automobiles, the building of lighter, smaller cars with smaller engines, the raising of gas prices, a graduated tax on the weight of the car, and the mileage standards are all kind of conservation measures, some of which have actually been instituted in this country. None of these are very glamorous, but each in its way helps to conserve gasoline.
None is very radical either.
No. Trouble is with conservation is it isn't very glamorous. It's the kind of nitpicking stuff. It's getting down in your basement and tacking up more insulation. My son and I put an extra layer of insulation in our attic, and it was a hell of a job. It was messy, dirty, it crawled through spaces. I really sweated it. Well, I'm saving a little energy, but it's very interesting. A lot of these things are not easy to do, and people put them off. Of course, that's retrofitting, but building codes, which insist upon thermopane windows or double windows and adequate insulation, are all steps which will help. But those building codes in some places, I guess, are in force, but I don't think too many places. Mainly the market that's been used to spur people into doing this sort of thing. Industry. Many industries have found dramatic savings from just turning out the lights, turning down temperatures, improved housekeeping of various things such as maintaining heating systems and so forth, recovery of wastes, recycling of aluminum now is a large industry, cogeneration, which I've mentioned, and most industries are becoming very cost conscious. As they install new technological equipment, they attempt to make sure it's energy efficient. And finally, buildings. Actually, 36% to 40% of United States energy goes to heating buildings and air conditioning buildings and lighting buildings and heating hot water. 36% to 40% go to air conditioning, heating, lighting, and hot water. And a lot can be done, as I've said, in terms of building codes and to make buildings more energy efficient. I suspect one of the things we may go back to is skyscrapers with open windows. I don't know if you're aware of how energy efficient we've been building our tall buildings in cities. They have no open windows, great facades of glass which have very poor insulating capabilities already, I noticed in Seattle and other places, that the buildings have less window space than they did just 5 years ago. Very interesting change that has occurred in just a period of 5 years. In your own house, as you start buying houses, if you are foolish enough to get into the house buying industry, there's a lot of things you can do. I noticed I did an energy audit last February and have been installing such things as jackets on my hot water heater, new insulations. You can buy heat pumps, which cost $3,000 or $4,000. 36% to 40% go to air conditioning, heating, lighting, and hot water. And a lot can be done, as I've said, in terms of building codes and to make buildings more energy efficient. I suspect one of the things we may go back to is skyscrapers with open windows. I don't know if you're aware of how energy efficient we've been building our tall buildings in cities. They have no open windows, great facades of glass which have very poor insulating capabilities already, I noticed in Seattle
in other places that the buildings have less window space than they did just 5 years ago. Very interesting change that has occurred in just a period of 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
In your own house, as you start buying houses, if you are foolish enough to get into the house buying industry, there's a lot of things you can do. I noticed I did an energy audit last February and have been installing such things as jackets on my hot water heater, new insulations. You can buy heat pumps, which cost $3,000 or $4,000. I did a job on the getting thermopane for all my windows and discovered that it would cost me $2,900 to put thermopane in. So let me tell you, it's not cheap if you do that. I didn't do that yet. I'm going to maybe do it a little bit at a time. But it's an expensive proposition. Some of these items don't pay back either if you're interested in conservation. The idea, that leads to a very important point, which is part of the energy policy section which follows here, is that it may be worthwhile as a society is that we provide incentives for people to install energy-saving things in their house. It may even pay people to conserve energy, because if you figure the cost of providing ever more energy and the cost of insulation, if we could pay people the difference between the cost of providing new energy and the insulation, they would pay then for people to do it. And there's a lot of things that can be done along those lines. Well, that's all I have to say on conservation. In terms of the outline here, I take that and solar to be the two primary areas in which we should be working. And once those two are exploited, as I hesitate to use the word exploited, but become primary priorities in social policy, it seems then and only then that we should then turn to other forms of energy. And so on page 14, I want to spend the rest of the time this morning looking at some policy options. But let me pause here and see if there's any questions on all these energy forms. We've gone through a good number. There are at least a dozen different categories in effect that we have dealt with here. I just want to see if there's any questions.
The energy audit that you mentioned, there are agencies and nonprofit agencies and government agencies, etc., that help us do that, to measure the room and the square footage of the window compared to the wall, and how much heat passes through a single pane, and then a chart that says how much will pass through double and triple glazed windows, and all those, and the kinds of insulation all around. And it is not, if you use the formula that are available, it's not all that complicated to figure out. You came up with $2,900, decided that was not a worthwhile offset to the energy savings, but the whole process is interesting.
The guy from the gas company who came out who gave me the estimate of $2,900 said, I could pay that back in 7 or 8 years, but I did a little figuring and there's no way that I could pay that back in 7 or 8 years in terms of energy saving, even by the most hopeful estimates on the amount of energy I would save. In fact, that it was unlikely that I'd ever pay it back.
Yeah.
One of the areas, too, as far as the church is concerned, you look at most of our churches, many of our churches are not built as energy saving buildings.
Oh. I mean, just look at the space, huge semi-Gothic or neo-Gothic stuff that huge ceiling space and all the heat goes up. And so in the last couple of years, several fairly simplified packets have been prepared for churches and also for individuals, for property management committees of the congregations to go through their own. And we had just started that in our church. Ours is a very low ceiling in San Francisco, and so there's not a lot of loss. But I was thinking of this area over the Midwest, where we have thousands of churches, and most of them are built 20 years or so or longer ago. Terribly energy inefficient, I would guess.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I know one particular congregation in Minneapolis that $500,000 goes into heating that building.
$500,000?
$500,000. It's a relatively new church. It's a massive auditorium in Burnsville. Just identify it. But $500,000 goes to heating and summer cooling. I mean, you got to cool it because it gets too hot in the summer.
And you gotta heat it because it's a massive auditorium in a way.
It's incredible. The section on church responsibility in here points to that question of running a church energy audit. And as you say, there's a book put out by the Methodist Church, I think the only one I've seen in print, which is very effectively does
the one that
follows
we got
on energy audits.
ALC may have borrowed
them. Yeah, I'm sure.
My guess is that's where it came from.
Most denominations are using that now because to run their own is like reinventing the wheel. There's no sense doing it.
Okay, thank you.
She did it.
She finished her scarf.
You can do more. I mean,
maybe we ought to have a moment
kind of
meditation.
Sort of a control scheme. I mean, between. Go ahead.
No, I'll let it out.
But most gas companies will also run a personal energy audit on your house for you, and there are ample books. I attended a series of seminars last February and March in Tacoma where a lot of good information was put out. They were held down at the local gas company, and they put out a lot of useful information in booklets and pamphlets on conserving energy. A lot can be done, and a lot of people are doing it as they find their energy bills go up. I've noticed my gas bill for the same amount of energy or less, which I'm consuming now, the over 6 years, the gas bill has doubled or gone up two and a half times. Now, that's a lot of incentive for people to make changes. But I also point out that those higher prices have an impact on poor people is rather severe. And when that, we have to talk about that in terms of policy options, because one of the things that really does need to happen is to raise the price of fuel oil, because we really have been pricing it too low in terms of its availability for the future, and it really has to go up. But in the process of rising prices, you have a tremendous impact on the poor, which if we neglect, I think we're neglecting one of our most important imperatives coming from Christianity, which is care for the poor. Well, let's look at some of those policy options on page 14 for the time that's left, and the ones we don't finish you can read. And I also point out that the section on page 16 on church responsibility, I'm not going to do that. That's pretty mundane stuff. And we'll then on Friday look at page 17, the question of personal responsibility or personal lifestyles, and conclude this series of discussions. Policy options. The first seems to me is making some sort of decision about the time of transition. Some people advocate that the transition to to a new era of energy consumption should be a let happen by market forces. Let the prices rise, let people select more energy efficient things, and basically let the market take care of things. Don't try to intervene in that. Unfortunately, this is likely to lead to a very slow transition and a very unjust one, because it will hurt certain people very dramatically. And so it seems to me that we have to talk about an accelerated transition in which there are certain priorities or goals. So I'm calling for here an accelerated transition, a speeding up of the time, and the goals or the emphases during that period of speed up would be on conservation, appropriate size, that is many different kinds of sizes of energy sources, but particularly appropriate size now means attention to more decentralized and smaller and simpler energy sources, renewable forms of energy, in particular solar, and an increasing investment in research to reduce the risk and increase the efficiency of all energy forms, and three, a decreased reliance in the transition on oil, gas, coal, and nuclear. That may not be possible with the need to provide basic needs, but as a priority, I want to insist that those come after solar conservation and conservation as energy sources. And fourth is the restatement of the principle which I've been stating many, many times, is to take as a first priority the provision of basic needs for all people. And included in this is later on the next page, there has to be a differentiation between needs and wants. Basic needs are not unlimited, anything I feel like I need kind of demands, but the basic needs are for food, clothing, housing, and some margin above subsistence. In our society, I suspect basic needs includes transportation, because we have built a society which on rapid transit transportation, and we really must find ways to transport people once we've built the system. This does not necessarily mean automobiles, by the way. Now, there are certain policies to accelerate the transition. First is a set to decrease total energy demand, particularly for oil, gas, coal, and nuclear, but indeed total energy demand as well. Now, there's various ways to do this, by manipulating the price through taxes, rationing, and the setting of mandatory standards. The example of 55-mile-an-hour limit and the mandatory standards for new automobiles and energy consumption are examples of this. So there has to be options among those. Secondly, are options to increase investment in conservation and in renewable forms of energy. Examples are tax incentives, low-interest loans, direct subsidies, and taxation of less expensive alternatives, and free installation of such things as insulation. The recommendation here is nothing specific in terms of one over the other, but options are recommended which do not place a disproportionate burden on the poor, yet accomplish the tasks of efficiency and reducing energy demand. You have a kind of twofold goal that you want to accomplish with your options, which is justice, so that certain groups of people are not disproportionately burdened, and actually reducing demand and increasing efficiency. And I further go on to say in item D is that sometimes these goals are not compatible. The problem of not placing a disproportional burden on certain groups, in particular the poor, at the same time accomplishing your goals of energy efficiency and reducing consumptions may not be compatible. The example is the one I cited of rising prices. If we let the price of gasoline go up, and it's the poor people who and Jim Fish who own those gas-guzzling cars, those are the people that get hurt when you raise the price of gasoline.
Got a picture, Jimmy.
So if such be the case, if we insist on using higher prices as our way of allotting scarce resources and reducing consumption, then it seems to me that we must institute other kinds of programs to compensate the people who are very badly hurt, in particular the poor. Lifeline rates, guaranteed annual income, increased public transit.
What do you mean by lifeline rates?
Lifeline rate is a basically the utility gives a lower rate to aged senior citizens. That's very prevalent. Or if people can't pay their bill, you just don't shut off their gas or electricity. You actually carry them as an expense to the utility. In many places, that's actually occurring. The utilities are not too happy about that policy because they feel that such should be a public responsibility. But in fact, many utilities are operating that way. So lifeline rates, a more progressive tax system, and job retraining. Furthermore, we recommend here a significantly increased private and public aid, which directly improves the living conditions of the world's poorest, not just American poor, but the world's poorest. This is, of course, a call to greater sharing and giving with people that aren't as fortunate as we are. The next one, F, is a kind of iffy one. I'm calling for options which discourage the export of energy-intensive technologies to other countries, particularly third world countries, except where there can be a clear and distinct advantage to the poorest. I guess I have some real problem with American capital and energy intensive forms of technology going to third world countries and bringing them into a culture and system which really is unsustainable in its very design. There are certain areas, however, where energy-intensive and capital-intensive kind of and sophisticated technologies can actually help people. Consequently, it seems to me where this is can be shown to be this advantage can be shown that there is still some call for these kinds of technologies. Finally,
who would set that kind of criteria?
Well, again, this is one of the reasons it's iffy is the that would require some sort of restriction on American enterprise. Well, I don't have any solution for that. Besides a kind of moral suasion, I don't know how the government can, given the present setup of our laws, can say to a corporation like Exxon or General Electric or someone like that, that you can't export these technologies. But what's really occurring in the third world countries, as we discussed, is that many places there is the export of these technologies, which the benefits from which are go to a small elite in those countries, and the actual impact is, in many cases, the impoverishment of poor people. And I don't know how we stop that, but somehow I would advocate policies that would encourage the stopping of that. Again, I have no magic solution here, except I don't have any kind of magic solution at this point. We could perhaps put an export tax on certain forms of technology. Would be one thing, of one way of discouraging that. Another way would be for agencies that dispense foreign aid to only dispense foreign aid for certain purposes, none of which would be for the import of sophisticated energy and capital-intensive technology. Those are ways that could be done. We're nowhere near that, doing that.
The reason I asked the question is because I got into this long and rather heated argument with my father a couple, 3 years ago when the government put some restrictions on major oil companies, et cetera. And he had worked 35 years for Standard Oil Company, was retired, but he felt that the oil companies ought to police themselves, let them set the, you know, police themselves. But I didn't see that happening with massive windfall profits, et cetera, going on. And I can imagine putting self-restraint, any business, I can hardly imagine any business putting self-restraint on their free enterprise without some really significant government incentives.
Well, they have a further incentive to export these kinds of technologies, because not only do they gain a profit from it, but they appear to be helping people. There are people in those countries who get jobs out of these new kinds of technology. Often overlooked is the people in the backwaters, in the rural villages, where that technology never extends, and when it does, it really marginalizes them. But they have enough justification for their export to say that they're really providing a social good in those countries. But it's a mixed kind of bag, and you're probably more selective in your evidence. So when you call for self-policing, they say, well, look at all the good we're doing. And that's a standard kind of response. Gulf and Western down in Dominican Republic with all its fancy tourist hotels, look at all the jobs we're providing for the people.
Same kind of arguments used in the whole question of divestment, et cetera.
Sure. Mm-hmm. There's no magic, and those companies certainly have a lot more power than I do or any church does in recommending a policy like this, but it's down on paper here anyway. It's being the moral conscience of the church, if nothing else.
I think it's an important element to have there. It's just really tough to find something that will in fact work.
That's
without
true.
The cry of infringement on rights, etc.
Well, the cry is justified, because to do it, it would require some infringement. There's
got 4 years now to look ahead to see if, in fact, more laws will be lifted off of Standard and Exxon and Gulf and Western, etc., and we'll just see how that ends up.
The prospects are not good.
Not too
high. And in some cases, those companies actually—it's not a one-way bag. I don't want to sit here and attack multinationals, because they're working according to the dynamics of the system under which they've operated for years, and they're not mean people. Some of them are, but most of them are folks just like it's your father and my uncle and aunt and things like that. Not mean people, but people that are part of a system which does some good in some places and does great evil in other places, and trying to clear up the one while preserving the other is a tricky business. Finally, we recommend options which encourage new attitudes of reduced energy consumption and new notions of status to replace the current notion stressing consumptive lifestyles. I'm not sure how that you can work that into any kind of social policy, but such as the one possibility would be the discouragement of advertising of energy-intensive products. Like France has done. They've had a lot of flack, and their government runs, their legal system works slightly differently than ours. Ours is much more laissez-faire, but I think that there are possibilities. I would discourage, I guess, if I had the power to do it, advertising of high consumption, highly consumptive lifestyles. Say again.
La machine.
La machine, yes. Okay.
You go up against General Motors, that's who you'd take on with that one.
Oh, sure.
I mean, it would be a horrendous battle.
Well, and it's not just General Motors, but it's the possibility of this trade-off between jobs and consumption.
Yeah.
There's a tricky one, at least in the short range, which is talked about next in this policy statement. You have, at least in the short range, if you cut back consumption on a mass scale in this country, if everybody did exactly what many people are suggesting we do, we would have mass unemployment in the short range. Now, things can be done in the long range to temper that, and even in the short range, things can be done, but once you build a system one way, changing it to the other way is not an overnight kind of proposition. But that's why encourage new attitudes to reduce energy consumption. We're going to have to, you know, if we speed up a transition, move it so that the people don't get hurt in the process of making some transition. And the people that would get hurt, if everyone, for example, bought a car every seventh year instead of every third or fourth year, would mean vast unemployment in the automobile industry around Detroit, which is a lot of black folks and people who are not extremely rich, though I must say that if you have a job in an auto plant, you make a fairly good wage. But a lot of people whose lives would be really broken up by that kind of policy if it's too precipitously done. I don't think we have anything to worry about soon, by the way. So you can call for, I think it seems to be important to call for reduced energy lifestyles now. It may be that we would have to moderate that call if everybody took us up on that, but that does not seem to be the problem at this point. Well, it's about 10 o'clock. I'll let you read the rest of those and not go through them item by item, but basically they're policies for various contingencies. I'm trying to say is that there may be a conflict between environmental safeguards and safety precautions and the provision of basic needs, that basic needs takes priority, that we may have to reduce environmental safeguards, but I would suggest that we don't do that as the first thing, but only after we have really made some sort of serious commitment to conservation and to solar energy and other renewable forms. Nuclear and coal, justice, participation in appropriate size with efficiency, and consumption with employment I mentioned. Policies are recommended which provide for investment and retraining necessary to help displaced workers. If you're going to dramatically change your social direction and eliminate certain industries, then it seems to me that the society has a responsibility for picking up the broken lives or helping pick up the broken lives that result. And nuclear power, nuclear proliferation, there's no magic solution to that problem. When a third world country wants to participate in decision making and their decision is that they want a nuclear power plant, which is big technology, what do you do? I have no immediate solution to that problem except to suggest that an eventual goal should be the elimination of all plutonium-based energy sources. That means conventional and breeder. Eventually is something that we should eliminate totally from the world energy picture. Sooner the better. But again, the other criteria that needs to be balanced is the provision of basic energy needs, and so you have some trade-off there.